Words. Evening, everybody. It's great to be back, see everybody. Alan and Ruth are back from their distant travels, and Peter's here. We haven't seen Peter in a while. And everybody, so I feel very happy to be home. And thanks to Sue for doing such a great job taking care of seminar while I was gone. She had a good time. She sent me a card and said she really, really enjoyed herself, really enjoyed Hakuin. And I know you had a visitor that was much appreciated. So while you were here doing all that, Kathy and I have been moving around. We haven't been home for quite a while. We were away all of March and just until the other day. First in New York with our children and grandchildren. Then we went to Paris, where I have a new poetry book, which is published by the, my French accent is not too good, but Presse Université de Rouen et Havre. So Pure, P-U-R-H. So this university press has a series that they're very proud of. Every year they bring out a couple of books by contemporary American poets. They bring out two simultaneous titles, one in English and the same book translated into French. As everywhere in the world, when a book is translated from one language to another, it's a book that already exists, right? It's been published in this one language. French, an American poetry book was published in America, translated into French, comes out in French. They're very proud of the fact that this is an original book that comes out in France, in English. So they're very focused on this. They think this is the greatest thing. So they're proud of it, and every year they bring the poets to France, and they have a conference, and they make a big to-do about it. So that's what we were doing there. We were we had an event pretty much every day. There was a conference in Rouen, which is a university town about 90 minutes away from Paris by train. So it was a chance for me to schmooze with my poetry friends that I don't get to see very often and do a lot of readings and appearances in Paris. And wherever I went, my translator came with me so I could read from the book in English and she would read the French. But then we had to rush home because it was Passover and we had to make a Seder. So this is a lot of work in a jet-lagged state. And we never did this before, we had a silent Seder. It's the opposite of what Seders are supposed to be. This was like in total silence. No singing, no words, nothing. We did all the ritual things. We had the Haggadah, the book, you know, we read the book. But we did the entire thing in absolute silence. You can do this when there's no children there, and there weren't any children, just a few. There was a very small group of us. And this was the greatest thing. I didn't know how great this could be. So, silence is great. It really is. It's you forget how great silence is and how profound it is and how much insight and depth comes just from silence. So I recommend silence. We should all be silent more often. As you know, Judaism is a religion almost entirely of words and interpretation, which is great if you like words and interpretation, as I do. But a little silence is a good idea for Judaism, too. So it worked very well. In silence, you can understand things that you miss when you're talking. And I actually found that it was the most profound Seder. I really understood much more and appreciated much more the meaning of the ritual in silence than I ever have with words. So then we had about a day or so to clean up from all that and put the Passover dishes away and pack for our exciting camping trip in Death Valley, where we were met our son and grandchildren. And so there we were in Death Valley, which I'd never been to Death Valley. It's a fabulous place, yeah. 289 feet below sea level at the lowest place. We were walking there in the Salt Flats. And then from there we went to Deep Springs College, which is an amazing place. I don't know if this is where our son Aaron went to college. It has 26 students. And it's located in the middle of a high, gigantic desert valley in the White Mountains, on a road between Bishop, California, and the Nevada border. 26 students in the middle of this vast space, which is also a small farm that grows alfalfa and raises cattle and pigs. And there are the students' half-time work and half-time study. The landscape and the loneliness of the desert space is really lovely. Aaron, our son, is on the board of trustees now, so that's why we went there, so that he could go to a trustees meeting while we were camping out next door with the kids. And we had a great time. However, setting up and taking down tents every day, because we kept moving every day, and cooking meals and washing dishes while being responsible for two rambunctious children, 9 and 5 years old, is tiring. It's tiring. At least for me, I was tired. But we're back now into our quiet, easygoing life. So thank you all for letting us do all these fabulous things. We really had a good time. While we were gone, not only is Sangha life continuing here, but the rest of the world is going on with its madness. Thanks to smartphones, which work almost everywhere, we could keep abreast of the news, not as much as usual, but a little bit. And, you know, the news is so dramatic these days. I think everybody's quite thrilled, in all senses of that word, with the dramatic news. It's so dramatic that it's easy to forget that real life is far more than what you read in the newspaper. And which maybe is the point of our doing what we do in practice, to remind us that real life is not what you read about every day in the newspaper. Things are so much better and worse than the news of the day would lead you to believe. Anyway, among the very many dramatic things going on in the world is the continuing Rohingya crisis in Burma. And our Dharma brother, Alan Sanaki, has just been there. And today I got an email, an appeal for help from the Buddhist community. So Laura's going to forward that email to you, and you'll get it this week. And it invites you to sign things and make donations if you want. This is particularly an issue that I think Western Buddhists feel like they want to get involved with, because there's a lot of bad behavior going on the part of the Buddhists of Burma, or at least so it appears. So we have 3 more weeks left in our April seminar meetings. And so for the next 3 weeks, we're going to read through this wonderful book, which I guess many of you have gotten, Zen Seeds, Reflections of a Female Priest by Shundo Aoyama. You can easily find it if you just... Aoyama, Shundo, Shundo, Shundo Aoyama, Zen Seeds, Reflections of a Female Priest. It'll right away pop up and you can buy it. There is no PDF text of it, though. I checked. One time, Ayama Roshi came to visit us at Zen Center many years ago, and she was a very impressive person. Very quiet, very simple, shining little woman with a big smile and a gigantic heart. I don't know much about her. You can't find out too much about her on the internet, other than that she's the abbess of two temples, or had been anyway, the abbess of two temples, one of which was one of the few training monasteries in Japan for women, for nuns. And she's written a lot and is pretty well known in Japan. She was born in 1933, and as far as I know, is still alive. I believe she's still alive. My old Zen friend from Pennsylvania, Diane Benaj, who spent about 20 years training in Zen in Japan, was a student of Aoyama Roshi and is in fact the translator of this book, beautifully translated. Coincidentally, as we're just starting this, I got an email was forwarded to me from the Everyday Zen website from one of Diane's students who said, "When is this session, the Everyday Zen session? We want to send two or three of us want to come to the Everyday Session," because Diane has retired now and she's not leading session anymore. And she said we should come to Everyday Zen session.
We've met with them.
Have you?
It's a really nice group.
In Pennsylvania, did you go there?
Very sane people.
Yeah, oh yes, yes, yes. It turns out that a lot of Buddhists are sane. It's nice. It's nice when you find that, yeah. In a world full of insane people, it's nice to find a few sane Buddhists. Not that all Buddhists are sane, but when you find a sane one, it's nice. Yeah, so I was embarrassed to tell her, and maybe you've noticed this too, that we're having like bad technical difficulties with the website. And we are unable to post our events. So we're trying to fix this. And I think because I've been traveling, it's hard to, you know, sort of tend to it. But we may end up having to send an email to everybody with a bunch of key events that you can't find on the website until we fix this. But John reminded me that it would be really good to tell everybody right now that for reasons beyond our control, in the fall, our annual session is going to be earlier than usual. It won't be at the end of October. It'll be early in October. I've forgotten the dates now.
Third to ninth.
Yeah. So, just so you know that, because a lot of times people anticipate these things and plan, and we should send out the dates for the session in Canada and Mexico and all that too. Yeah, it's different days of the week, yeah. They told us they would give us the same dates, but somehow or other didn't work out. Anyway, so same place, Santa Sabina, yeah. So anyway, so that was a nice coincidence, and I'll have to tell, I didn't email her back, and I'll tell her that we're reading Aoyama Roshi's book, and this will make Diane very happy, I think. So we've lately been, you know, reading books like by contemporary women teachers. We read some, or maybe we didn't read the whole thing, but I was quoting from Catherine Thanis' book and Blanche Hartman's book. And usually when a book like this comes out, it comes with some kind of a context. There's an introduction, there's a foreword. It tells you about the person, it tells you about what the book's going to say. There's blurbs on the back that make comments about the book. Before you even start the book, you know all this stuff about the book. That's sort of the way books are presented nowadays. Someone tells you first what the book is and who wrote it before you read it. You already know all that, right? That's how it is now. But this book doesn't have any of that. No foreword, no introduction. You have no idea who Aoyama Roshi is, what her life is like. Just kaboom, she starts writing. So that's kind of nice, actually. It's refreshing. So I thought what I would do for this 3-week period, maybe the book is about 150 pages long. We could just roughly read it in three pieces, you know, 50 pages this week, next week 50, the next third week 50. And I think what I'll do is every week I'll just come and read a few passages that I found interesting, noteworthy, and maybe make just a few comments. and then we can have a discussion. So the very first, and it's divided into small, fairly small little sections, chapters, like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and other books like this. This seems to be the form of them. They're chapters. They're, because they're excerpts from Dharma talks, rather than quoting the whole Dharma talk, it just will give you an excerpt. So I'm going to read you the very first one because it's so lovely. Hearing the Voice of the Valley Stream, which is, I think, also the title of a Dogen fascicle. The water of the valley stream is always flowing. It races on, not pausing for even an instant. Its sound, to me, is the sound of time. The water of time glistens on the riverbed of the universe. Though theirs is a much slower flow, stones, trees, houses, and towns are flowing too. Those of us who have been living around this area for a long time have seen the city of San Francisco flowing quite a bit since 1970. Lots of flowing going on in that city, as in every city. Human beings and all things that have life flow. Thought and culture, too, flow. That all these appear to be unchanging is an illusion. We make every effort to keep things as they are because human beings alone lament transience. I don't think it means human beings alone. I think it means, in other words, only human beings. Other creatures don't lament this. Only human beings lament transience. Yet no matter how we grieve or protest, there is no way to impede the flow of anything. If we but see things as they are and flow with them, we may find enjoyment in transience. Because human life is transient, all manner of figures are woven into its fabric. At the beginning of Zazen meditation, when all is still, the sound of the valley stream is loud and clear. When we pace slowly after meditation to ease leg pains and drowsiness, the sound of the stream seems to be less audible. When Zazen is completed, the sound cannot be heard at all. Why should this be? The sound of the valley stream doesn't actually increase, diminish, or disappear. When the waves in our minds become calm, we can hear the voices of the water, pebbles, grasses and trees, rivers and mountains, teaching us. When our thoughts are occupied with events in the outer world, these non-sentient beings cease their speech. Rather, it is not that they no longer speak, but that when we are caught up by the outer world, we have no ears to hear. As it is with our ears, so it is with our eyes. When the mind's eye is clear, we see all existences naturally as they are. But the moment our attention is distracted by even a single thought of the outer world, that which is seen is no longer registered truthfully in our minds. We become blind, just as we become deaf to the sounds around us. When our attention is pulled here and there, we no longer see what we should be seeing, hear what we should be hearing. When we listen subconsciously to the sound of flowing water, does it not seem to create a rhythm? Yet not a single drop of water passes over the same rock twice, and the murmur of water rushing over a rock is constantly changing. Sameness is but an illusion of the human ears, eyes, mind. Water that has once flowed along a river bed can never retrace its course. And human life is no different. It is only our mundane eyes and minds that see yesterday as being the same as today. Enlightened eyes and minds should recognize that each moment has a form different from that of any other moment. It's a beautiful passage, I think, to open the book. So I think maybe the reason it begins the book is that it's sort of talking about the most important part of our practice, and really the most fundamental thing, the thing that I think Zen practice and other forms of contemplative practice uniquely offer the world. We do Zazen. It's so central to our practice. Without Zazen, I don't think we would all be here. And we do Zazen with a lot of focus and a lot of intensity. And because this is so central to our practice, we do find a deeper sense of our lives. In the hustle and bustle of things that seem so important, things in our own private lives, you know, family things, things in the world, seem so important and significant. It's easy to forget. Boy, Peter, are you all right?
Amazing. Yes, I enjoyed
you must be some dust in the rug or something.
Routine.
Oh yeah. Clears out the system. Yeah.
Yeah. Excuse me.
That's all right. Anyway, I was saying that, you know, life gets busy and we're all wrapped up in things that seem so important, and they are important. But when we completely forget about this other life that is always there and is always necessary, even when we don't notice it, this is not good for us. Maybe this, whatever you want to call it, this space of being in our lives that Zazen cultivates in us, maybe this space is not the only thing there is. Maybe it's not even the most important thing there is. But it is actually important. And when you forget about it, you easily become unhappy and obsessed, and you can become bitter and resentful. Plenty of reasons for all of those emotions, if you want to have them. And life becomes a lot more unpleasant and difficult, really, than it needs to be. So we come back to the cushion, and we're sitting every day, and we're sitting once a month all day, and we're sitting once a year 5 days, maybe more than that. We're sitting all so that we can stay in touch with this feeling for life that she's describing in this passage. We can stay in touch with it, and it can be there all the time. Even when we don't feel it directly, we never forget about it. It can always influence our hearts, our minds, our bodies, all the time. That's our practice, is to more and more have it be like that. And so it's beautiful the way she describes it here. And now I was really inspired by this very second one, too. Maybe I'll read the entire book, you know. This one is called, I Want to Become a Beautiful Person. People walk about totally unaware that their faces and bodies reveal everything about the way they have lived. Such nakedness can be embarrassing, even frightening. Thank God we don't know that this is true. It would all be like, we'd all be hiding, you know. All we have thought or said and all we have done since birth has molded our faces, bodies, and personalities. With a single glance, a clear-eyed person can perceive our entire history. Was it Lincoln who said that a man is responsible for his looks after the age of 40? It is in the 40s that the face and body, as if shaped continuously from birth by an unseen chisel, reveal a beauty or ugliness that cannot be disguised by cosmetics or clothing. The modern Japanese poet and calligrapher Yaichi Aizu once wrote to an acquaintance, My friend, by being circumspect in everything, I think you do. By having a heart at peace, I hope to become a beautiful person. I feel that I, too, would like to age in that way. So this is a very interesting point for those of us in the room, which is pretty much all of us, who would say that we're in an aging time of life. Funny that we say we're aging. Yeah, as if we just started aging. Before that, we weren't aging. Aging, we think aging starts when you're 50 or 60 or 70 or something like that. But you're aging all the time, flowing, right, all the time. So maybe when we're younger, you know, it's other people who are mostly forming us, right? Other people are, you know, like our little grandchildren, like, they didn't decide they wanted to go to Death Valley. It wasn't their idea, you know. They were going to Death Valley. Everything about their lives, they didn't decide. At some point, though, it's you who makes you. So it's a wonderful thing to think of aging after 40 as being a process of making yourself beautiful. Isn't that a great concept? Who thinks of aging as a process of making yourself beautiful? We think of it as the opposite process, right? We're becoming ugly, we're becoming old, we're becoming washed up, we're losing our functionality. But why look at it that way? Why not look at it the way she looks at it? Aging is a process of becoming beautiful. Well, why not see it like that? So these first two passages, this one and the one I just read a moment ago, remind you that this month we're going to be sitting at Nature Bridge at the end of the month on the 29th, April the 29th, a little more than 2 weeks from today. And it's a special sitting because we'll be celebrating the Buddha's birthday, which means life. Springtime, flowers, children, joy. But we'll also be having a Jukai ceremony for two of our becoming beautiful people in our Sangha, Jane and Naomi. So it's even better, even more profound to think, isn't this wonderful, to think of committing to the precepts as committing to becoming beautiful. Isn't that a beautiful way to look at it? So I want to remind all of you to put that on your calendar. Please come to the day, and if you can't come to the day, come anyway to the ceremony, which will start about 4:00. And as you saw from these passages, one of the beautiful features of the book is Aoyama Roshi's wide range of references. She quotes a lot of Japanese poets that I have never heard of, as well as many Western poets and other writers. And here she's mentioning Lincoln, right? And recently I saw a ranked list of American presidents. And of course, Lincoln is the first greatest president, right? This is the order of greatness, right? Our current president, it'll be interesting to see like where he is ranked. But I doubt very much that he'll surpass Lincoln's rank as the number one greatest president. He's greatest because he had the greatest problems and the greatest tragedies of any other president. That's what makes him the greatest president. He had these great tragedies and he bore them with dignity and some wisdom. And he is the greatest president also because it seems that he was a sad and tragic person who maintained, nevertheless, a beautiful, quiet sense of humor because he lived through all these things. And then, of course, his end was a tragic end. certainly he's the most soulful of all American presidents, and possibly one of the most soulful Americans who ever lived. And I'm thinking about Lincoln because I've been reading George Saunders' great novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. Maybe some of you have read him. And you know, George Saunders is a very serious Buddhist practitioner. And I think Lincoln in the Bardo is like the most fully realized Buddhist novel in English that I've ever read, you know. It's amazing how it's really completely inspired by Buddhist perspectives and points of view. Wonderful, wonderful novel about mostly the death of Lincoln's son and how grief-stricken he was over that death, which only reminded him of the deaths of the many, 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 many young men who died in the Civil War that he was responsible for. So he had a huge burden of grief. Now I'm reading from page 16, Loving. I once presented an acquaintance with a souvenir I had chosen with care during a trip, expecting her to be delighted with it. She surprised me by saying, "I don't actually want this myself, but I'll take it because it will make a nice gift for somebody else." And I blurted out, "If I'd known you were wanting to give it away, I wouldn't have given it to you in the first place." In that instant, I realized my error. I saw how dreadful it is to mentally hold on to something I had already given away. I was unable to give unconditionally, saying, "You are free to throw it out or give it away. It is enough that you have accepted it." And I felt grateful, thinking, "How fortunate I am to have been exposed to the teachings of the Buddha so that I could recognize that part of me that clings to possessions." To paraphrase Rabindranath Tagore, another far-flung reference, "May my loving you not become a burden to you, for I have freely chosen to love you." In loving and giving unconditionally, Tagore avoided burdening the person he addressed. Realizing how much my thinking differed from Tagore's, I blushed in shame. This is a short piece. It's really interesting, I think. First of all, it shows Aoyama Roshi's great and seemingly quite sincere humility. Amazing, the idea that you could feel like this, grateful, when you notice your own limitations and your own smallness. Imagine feeling grateful. Not guilty or embarrassed or self-condemnatory, or wanting to hide it and not mention it to anybody, but grateful to see and own your own character flaws and ways that you're holding on. Grateful because you remember, thanks to the teachings, I can see this. And thanks to the teachings, I can practice with it, I can grow. All of our various limitations, it's a kind of a false view to think that I'm a terrible person, I'm like this. This is like setting up some kind of cockeyed ideology that makes no sense. What she says is perfectly in accord with the teaching. Yes, I see my limitation. Good. Now I'm lucky to be able to understand it as a limitation and to see it as a precious path of practice. That's how she looks at it. And yes, you know, who gives, who loves without conditions? Could we really say we do? Who doesn't expect love in return? Who doesn't expect at least a little gratitude in return for the loving we give Who doesn't get upset and feel betrayed when we don't get that love and gratitude? But did you ever think that to love with expectations is actually a burden for the other person? You know? Who ever thought that loving someone could be a burden to them? But it could be a burden, right? Your loving someone could be a burden to them. Loving without needing or expecting anything at all in return, just loving freely, is actually the only way to really love somebody without in any way burdening that person. Next page, 17. In another's place. An elderly woman who had told me that nothing made her happier than coming to the temple regularly to sing in the Buddhist chorus, because there's a lot of music that was on. When we go to Rinso Inn, you know, they always, usually we're there and all the women come from the village, from the town, to practice singing, and they have little bells and everything. It's very, very sweet Buddhist singing. Somehow we didn't get that memo from Japan, you know. We got the Zazen memo and the Kinhin memo and all that, but we didn't get the memo about singing. Anyway, this woman really loved singing. So she didn't come one day, and I asked her, next time the group gathered, I asked her what had happened. "Well," she said, "I got ready and I reached the door just as a visitor arrived. And she asked, 'Are you on your way out?' And if I had said yes, she would have turned around and gone home, thinking that would be a pity since she had taken the trouble to come over. I said, 'No, no, your timing is very good. I've just now returned. Do please come in.' So she came in. And that's why I wasn't able to go to rehearsal." "If that happened to me," Aoyama Roshi says, "what would I have said? I would have said, 'I'm so sorry you've taken the trouble to come because I'm just on my way out.' Or, 'I'm just on my way out, but it doesn't matter if I'm a little bit late, so please come in.' Or some other equally self-centered greeting." The old woman was an inspiration to me for her tact and thoughtfulness. So, you know, like, we're always, how many opportunities do we have to learn about the Dharma? All the time, you know, all the time, all day long. Everything from the birds to the trees to our family members to people we meet on the street are teaching us. And here again is Aoyama Roshi's great humility. And who could imagine anybody being that sensitive or that subtle or that caring for another person, that you would do what this old woman did? Who would ever do that? It's hard to believe. It's very Japanese. The Japanese actually have that at their best, you know, have that degree of sensitivity and subtlety. Sometimes hard for us to understand, you know. You can't understand the Japanese people sometimes for their sensitivity and subtlety of feeling. Page 19. Selfless religious practice. They say in Zen temples, when the wooden block is struck, it's the dining hall. When the bell sounds, it's the sutra hall. For the monks are called to meals by the striking of a wooden block and to sutra chanting by a bell. Everything we do in Zen is announced not through words, but through the sounding of instruments. When an instrument is sounded, practitioners must obey its signal at once. No matter what task one is performing, the signal must be obeyed instantly, even if it means leaving one's work half done. Though this seems an easy rule to follow, it is actually quite difficult. If I work just a little longer, I can finish everything, or just a little longer, this isn't a good place to stop, or some other excuse for not obeying is offered. It is at such times that we are caught up in self-centered thoughts of our own affairs, our own judgment. I tell practitioners, the signals are a supreme command. When you are called to cross the river of death, will you be able to say, please, wait a minute? You must follow instructions selflessly and answer yes without hesitating. This is the most important attitude. To paraphrase Zen Master Dogen, even if you practice Zazen so earnestly that you break through the floor, if your practice is only for yourself, it will come to nothing. So this one, brings up for us, as some of the other ones didn't necessarily bring up, the difference between Aoyama Roshi and ourselves. Aoyama Roshi is a monastic, has lived her whole life as a monastic. And we don't live that way. We have a very ordinary, everyday world that we live in. And I remember well, though, that, as some of you also remember, that feeling in the monastery that we get a taste of ourselves during our sessions, where you're always told, you know, just shut up and do the schedule. Just simply do the schedule. When the bell rings, go. Flow along with the signals, with the sounds. Flow along with the silent life of the temple. Drop all your personal preferences. The modern life, and maybe especially American life, is set up according to ideas of freedom, by which we mean choice and preference and a sense of independence. We want to be free to choose always what we do and to do it, make that choice on our own. What we do, when we do it, how we do it. On our little camping trip, I was truly amazed by how my grandchildren are constantly given choices all the time. What kind of food would you like now? Would you like this? Or would you like that? Would you like to have it in this bowl? Or would you like it in that bowl? Shall we use this cup or that cup? What would you like to do now? When would you like to go? So many decisions for a child to make. It's amazing. But choice isn't the same thing as freedom. I think freedom is embracing your life each moment, just flowing with your life, not limiting your life with too much choice and too definite identity and identity. And that's what choice is, right? Choice is an affirmation of identity. I wear these kind of shoes. I don't wear those kind of shoes. I like this. They ask children, you know, like when they're little, so what's your favorite color? You know, what's your favorite color? As if, like, what are you talking about, you know? It's like, what do you want to be when you grow up? You ask the five-year-old, you know? I often talk about Barry Schwartz's great book, The Paradox of Choice. It's a great book where he points out that the more choice you have, the more dissatisfied you are. It's true. He tells the story about buying a pair of jeans. You know that story. I have told it many times. He always used to buy jeans. Jeans are jeans. You buy them, they're fine. They're great. Jeans are great. You wear them for decades. So he had a pair of jeans. He wore them a long time. He finally wore them out. He went back to the store and he said, give me a pair of jeans. Here's my size. They said, do you want rinsed? Stonewashed, light denim, dark denim. What cut would you like? Boot cut, straight cut, relaxed cut. He was bewildered by all these choices. Finally, he, you know, was made to understand what all these choices meant, and he chose this and this and this and this and this. And he brought the jeans, took them home. They were much better than the jeans he'd ever had before. Of course, they're much better. And he enjoyed them a lot. And then he started thinking. He started thinking, you know, did I really want the relaxed fit? You know, the straight was always nice. You know, I don't know, these look very good. And I don't know about this rinsed. I got the rinsed. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but I'm not so sure. In other words, the more choice he had, the more chances he had to be dissatisfied. And I think that's what goes on in our contemporary life, you know. And it's not that choice is an evil thing, but, you know, one has to understand what's going on here with choice. It's very good. Choice is excellent for retailers of jeans, like The Gap. They love more and more and more choices, right? But not so good for the inner life of a person. So it's not a bad thing to just shut up and follow the schedule and have no preferences. You actually, once you get over the annoyance with this, and once you get over all your projections about this stupid, regimented, idiotic, immature Zen trip, and just flow with it, you really feel happy. And this really is mostly what Zen teaches, you know, actually. This is the most profound and wonderful offering of the practice. Just be happy with, let go of what you think you need, who you think you are, and just be happy with life. Because in the end, as she points out, that's the way it's going to be. And the other thing about the freedom and independence we all think is the goal of our lives is that it has a trap built right into it. Because most of the time, not always, but most of the time, or anyway, quite a bit of the time, my freedom of choice has an impact on yours. And when my freedom limits your freedom, or your freedom limits my freedom, the limitation is not just yours or mine, it's everyone's limitation. Whoever said that no one can be free unless everyone is free was right. I think this is a fundamental teaching, that in reality we are all one being flowing together. That's what you do in a monastery, right? It's like one person doing the monastic flow, one person sitting sesshin together. So you can't really privilege one over another. And you can't privilege human beings over other kinds of beings in this world. And the fact that we do this, and that we've almost completely lost track of this very profound teaching that's not only a Buddhist teaching, but you find in everywhere, makes for a very tough world in which more and more people are screaming for freedom. And the more they scream, the less free they are, all of us. Now I want to read you just one sweet passage on the bottom of page 21. I'm not going to read the whole section, but the last paragraph here says, revering him as the teacher who awakened to the true way, and with his teachings as our guide, we practice the Buddha's way at all times in our daily lives, supported by friends who aspire to the same way. If we are ill, so be it. If we are poor, so be it. In the very midst of sickness and poverty, we practice the way, relying on the three treasures, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Can any happiness surpass that afforded by this way of life? So that to me is so wonderful, you know? And I hope that this is something that we, little by little by little, together, come to as we continue practicing together all these many decades. That we come to see that we're not practicing, you know, because Buddhism is politically correct and fashionable in our moment. We're not practicing to make our lives better. We're not practicing to get more peaceful or more healthy. We're practicing because we love to practice. This is a happy life. This is happiness. Just to live and just to practice together, no matter what happens. All kinds of things are going to happen. we've already seen in our Sangha, right? All kinds of difficult things happening. They're going to happen. But we're going to practice. To practice is to be ready for anything. To be ready to accept anything that happens in our personal lives, in the world around us, everywhere. This doesn't mean, of course, to be passive or not to take care of things, but it means that practice itself and the process of practice itself is our life and our happiness. I'm going to read you one last one. This one is on page 43. Nothing is to be added. This is a little bit longer, this one. On Rishon, the first day of spring, according to the lunar calendar, I arranged a branch of plum blossoms just about to open in a vase in the alcove. The joy from this first breath of spring filled my heart, and I felt it to be the ultimate of luxuries. Time after time, I had stood under the boughs of the plum tree in the frigid air, thinking to myself how slow they were to blossom. Only a person who has waited impatiently for the slightest faint swelling in the buds will know this joy. I am able to find joy here because the gardens and fields in my temple accord with nature and its constant revolution of spring, summer, autumn, and winter. Throughout the year, florists and grocers sell a great variety of flowers and vegetables raised in greenhouses. Children growing up in an environment out of touch with nature are totally unable to recognize the promise of flowers blooming in early spring, despite bitter cold, or grasses flowering in the gentle autumn wind. At the store, flowers bloom out of season, and all kinds of fruit and vegetables are on display throughout the year. And we have choice, lots of choice. We can get food from anywhere we want, all the time. In the modern world, the thrill of seeing flowers bloom after a long winter, or the feeling of tenderness toward the last remaining flowers of autumn, cannot be experienced. Much less do we know the joy of picking the very first tomatoes and cucumbers of the season, or of tasting them after we've offered them on the Buddhist altar in our homes. We no longer know the joy of scooping up a fish in a net while feeling the pull of the stream on our legs. We don't feel pity when the fish dies. From the beginning, we are cut off from the natural environment which cultivates these emotions in our hearts. And it all starts with the idea that we can get anything we want with our money. And we can. But that doesn't enrich the emotions. As the words Mother Earth suggest, human beings are the Earth's children, nature's children. What kind of adults will modern children become, deprived of such a vital sense of nature, raised in an arid environment? In what direction will the society they build go? Just to imagine it sends chills up and down my spine. What has produced this environment? Our desires, always wanting to see the flowers we love and to eat our favorite fruits and vegetables, become entangled with another common human desire, that is, to make profits. To fulfill those desires, scientific technology has been utilized without control, and in the end, everything is made available for commercial sale, resulting in an inherently lifeless world. We must not forget that people living in such a situation gradually grow more materialistic and unfeeling. Their hearts become, as it were, plasticized and have no room for the Buddhist truth that life and death, as they are, is nirvana. Zen Master Kosho Uchiyama said, "The original way needs nothing to be added, nor is it clogged up. It perfectly suffices in itself. Because human beings have the ability to think, they always want to add something, and soon everything gets clogged up. Civilization today is clogged up as a result of the human desire to add more and more. Unless we change direction, before long there will no longer be human beings on our planet." With the guidance of the Buddhist doctrine encompassing the laws of heaven and earth, we must revive the human heart that is moved by one flower, a heart that cries at the death of an insect. Such a heart takes great care of one's own life, of other people's lives, and the life in all things. Now this is a voice that we don't hear very often, right, in our world. Who knows this? Who hears this? It's almost like we completely, not only did we forget what we're doing, we forgot there was any other thing to do. So, enough said. So, we're going to get into discussion groups. I think we have some time for discussion. And I'm going to ask us to consider three possible topics, and people in the group can pick different ones. And I'm going to say them now. I'll repeat them, but I'm saying them now for the recording. The first one. Do you have a feeling for this? Do you appreciate this virtue of silence and of returning to the flow of life that she speaks about? Can you stay in touch with it? How do you stay in touch with it? Do you? How do you? That's the first possible topic. The second one is about love. What are your thoughts on burdensome love and the possibility of a love that would be unburdensome? And I don't mean theoretically. I mean your life and your loving. And the third one, your thoughts on freedom and preference. How does this work in your life? Can you see this point? What is freedom? What is choice? What is preference? And how do they work together or work against each other? So those are the three topics. So let's get in groups of three. Just organize ourselves spontaneously, being sensitive to everyone in the room, so everyone's included.
And the group chooses one or each one?
Each one can choose whichever one they want, yeah. So.